complex biology of why some folks hold on to excess weight is just beginning to be fully understood. Having obesity is a complex interplay of biology and psychology, and it's time to stop framing obesity as a personal failure. The solution is not as simple as eat less, move more. Dr. Robin Pashby is a health psychologist with expertise in the impact of obesity on mental health and the impact of mental health on having obesity. And today she's joining me for a discussion on why we need to reframe the obesity conversation and, more important, how to do it. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. I met Dr. Pashby during my recent menopause retreat in Sardinia and was blown away by her work. Since then, I've become a Dr. Pashby groupie and just finished binging her lectures and presentations on YouTube, including an appearance last week at the Atlantic Festival. And I'm so excited to have this conversation. So welcome, Dr. Pashby.
What a cool intro. Thank you. I'm so happy to see you again and talk to you today.
Although, you know, come on, let's face it, this is not as much fun as when I got to hear you speak on the side of a mountain in Sardinia. I mean,
it will ever be as fun as that.
Was that trip, you know?
I know. It was so good.
What was the highlight for you?
Jumping off that cliff. I'm telling you.
I didn't go on that part. So tell everybody about jumping off the cliff.
Oh my
gosh.
Intentional,
not unintentional, first of all.
No, intentionally jumping off a cliff, which is why that's so counterintuitive. I'm a land animal. I like to have my feet on the ground. And going on this canyoning adventure, and I went up to the edge and I thought, no way I'm doing this. And I turned around and then I actually thought, what would my daughter do? My daughter is a daredevil. And I thought she would jump off this cliff. And so I turned around and did it. I'm feeling very proud of myself for that.
Honestly, you're braver than I am. I did not go on that trip. I went kayaking instead because I wasn't so brave. But I have to admit, I was a little bit sorry that I didn't do it. So kudos to you for doing it.
Thank you. It was really fun. Next time.
It was next time. All right. So can you just start by explaining what you do? I mean, what is a clinical health psychologist with an expertise in obesity? And what does this all look like? What does treating the mental health component of obesity actually entail?
Well, since there's maybe like three of us in the United States that do this, it's so strange to me that you don't know what we do. Okay. As an overstatement, obviously, to all my very respected colleagues, but there just aren't very many people. So to break this down, I got a dual track PhD, a clinical psychology track and a medical psychology track PhD, and I did my PhD in a medical school. So I have this very unique blend of understanding and training in the theory and practice of clinical psychology, but interwoven with medical school training. So I sat alongside physicians in training, in GI class, in endocrine class, in cardiology class, in pharmacology class. And so I think that gave me this really robust understanding of not just how people's minds work in terms of their emotional well-being, but also how their brains work in terms of neurotransmitters and how those factors influence people's general medical well-being. And yeah. So fast forward to today, I have basically spent the last 20 years trying to understand not just the emotional and mental health components of what it means to live with obesity and walk around in a world where obesity isn't perceived well, you could say, but also what are the sort of underlying neurological, biological, and so forth underpinnings of obesity and how those two things intersect. So in a nutshell, I talk about clinical health psychology lives at the intersection of physical and mental well-being.
But the thing about what you've just said that's so important is not only do you have a unique understanding into the biology of having obesity and really knowing what doctors know, but you also know what they don't know. And I think that that really must inform a lot of what you're doing when you are meeting with folks that are struggling, not only with what's going on in their lives, but what's going on in their medical care, which we're going to get to. But, you know, one of the things that you speak to quite a bit is the language of obesity. So explain why it's important not to say, hey, Debbie's obese, but rather to say, Debbie has obesity.
Right. So we know, I mean, the AMA has told us for, many, many, many years now that obesity is a chronic disease. Unfortunately, society has been slower to take that up and to really understand what that means. And so I think of, we often give the example, you don't say Debbie's cancerous, right? You say Debbie has cancer. And so why would we use it differently for a different chronic disease? You wouldn't say, oh, Jane is asthma-ish, right? You would say Jane has asthma, right? These chronic medical conditions are not our defining feature. They are a thing that we have to learn to manage and to deal with over the course of our lives. And obesity is no different than that. So using person-first language, which is putting the person before the condition, is simply the easiest way of recognizing that obesity is a chronic disease. Now, I'll put a big asterisk on this because it is really important to recognize that there is a whole community of people who are trying to reclaim the word fat, which in obesity treatment is seen as very disparaging, but in fat acceptance movements is really about a reclamation of that term. And so person-first language is really person-dependent language, because I do have some clients that don't want to be talking about their obesity. They want to be talking about their weight or their fat or other things. So I put that out there just because I don't want anybody listening to this in women's health who may ascribe to that. I don't want it to minimize what else we're going to talk about. I really do recognize the importance of that.
Okay. And I actually never heard that before. I wasn't aware of that. And so for the folks who do identify themselves as being fat as opposed to having obesity, do they frame it differently in terms of they're saying that it's not a disease, but this is just who they are? Or am I getting that wrong?
No, you're getting that close to right. And it depends, I don't want to talk, they're not a monolith, of course, right? Just like any other condition. And so there's a big variety of people. Some people do not believe that obesity is a chronic disease. I think we have enough data now to sort of adequately refute that standpoint. But I do understand and appreciate that all of this discussion comes from a historical bias and trauma that has occurred over the course of one's lifetime, and often generations of families who have been outright abused or otherwise disregarded because they live with high weight. And so I think that so much of the fat acceptance and body positivity movement is about saying enough of that, right? Enough of going into the doctor with a stuffy nose and coming out with a pamphlet for bariatric surgery. By the way, true story that happened to one of my clients.
No, believe me, I've heard those stories before. But I want to go back to, because you just kind of threw out there about traumatic experiences. And one of the things that you talked about at the Atlantic Festival was and I'm quoting you, the judgment, shame, anxiety, and depression from repeated traumatic experiences, from being made to feel that having obesity is their fault and that it's just a manifestation of lack of personal control, which of course brings me back to my introduction of a lifetime of people saying, just eat less, why don't you just eat less? But talk about that, about the repeated traumatic experiences and how that impacts the person, as they go through life.
Yes. The closest example I can give is we talk about microaggressions in racial, equity and these sorts of discussions. And microaggressions are happening all the time for people who are living in larger bodies. Let me give you some examples. I gave a talk. This is 10 years ago now, probably. I gave a talk to personal trainers at a gym, a franchise of a big gym. At the end of the conversation, we went upstairs, and as we were leaving, we sort of walked through the entryway, the lobby of the gym, and the whole talk was about reducing weight bias in personal training experiences and in gym settings in general, so that people living in larger bodies felt safe and accepted and welcome in gym, spaces. And they, you know, yes, we totally agree. We are a non-judgmental group here, this sort of thing. And as we're leaving, the largest t-shirt size is XL that they sell.
Yeah.
And that doesn't fit everyone, right? And I said to them, as an example, I said, think about what it says to a person who comes in needing a 2XL and is working out four times a week with one of your trainers paying you lots of money and decides they want to buy a t-shirt that says your gym name on it and then realizes, oh, I can't because I don't fit into what, you know, I should look like in order to represent your gym. That's the message that this person would walk away with. So that's like a microaggression. But then you compound that with outright abusive situations, whether it's parents who lock the fridge on their kids or, you know, I often tell the story about one of my clients who was leaving another gym in my local area in Washington, D.C., and literally had a car drive by her as she was leaving the gym with her gym bag on her shoulder and threw a bag of fast food trash out their window at her and yelled, "Hey, fatty, why don't you actually try using that gym?"
Oh my God. It just makes me want to cry, really.
It is horrible. And that's, I mean, I don't have to tell you, this is one out of thousands upon thousands of stories like this. And so I realized
let me just interrupt you 1 second, because you told a story in one of the tapes I was listening to that really resonated with me, because the same thing happened to me, is in fifth grade when they decide to weigh you at school and they line you all up in the gym and they put the scale in the middle of the room and the gym teacher weighs you and then they scream out your weight so that everybody can hear. And I was one of those kids. I actually was not, when I look back, I was perfectly normal for my size. I happened to grow very young. I was my exact same size now that I was in when I was 9 or 10 years old. So I was a good 20 pounds heavier than everyone else. And I just remember still all these years later,
yes,
how bad it made me feel, like there was something wrong with me because they yelled out this number that was so much higher. And you had that same experience.
That exact thing happened to me, except I was in third grade.
Yeah.
And I could see, I can still see the exact location. I know where the scale was in that gymnasium. You know, if I walked into that room today, I could walk you right to that spot. And so there, I just think that we have to conceptualize that these are, it wasn't like in your case or in my case, it wasn't like the gym teacher looked at me and said, "Ha ha, you're so disgusting and fat," and made fun of me. No, but the society has set us up that knowing that a bigger number is unacceptable happens early on. So I think there's some data that kids as early as 3 to 5 years old begin to choose the thin doll over the larger body doll, that thin is better, skinny is good. These sorts of messages in kids 3 to 5 years old.
Yeah, but it goes beyond, you know, skinny is good. It's what you were talking about earlier about the idea that this is your fault. And can you imagine if a woman went to her doctor and was diagnosed with, you know, heavy bleeding from fibroids or endometriosis, and the message was, yeah, you have this gynecologic problem and it's your fault. You know,
right.
That doesn't happen. It's like, oh, I'm so sorry you're struggling with this, and what can we do to help? So, you know, it's the shame part of it. And the other thing you talked about at the Atlantic Festival was this internalization of weight bias and living with public shame. And you gave a great example of, you know, the t-shirt example, if you want to just go through that one more time.
Yeah. I'll talk about that in just 1 second. I just want to say that the intersection of obesity with other chronic diseases or serious issues, for example, like what you just said, a person who has, you know, like fibroids or something else, right, comes in. Chances are, given statistics, this woman also has struggled with weight at some point in her life. And so what I hear is that you, as her gynecologist, might say, look, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry you're suffering with this. What can we do to treat it? Let's work together. What the patient then comes to my office and says is, if I weren't so overweight, I wouldn't have had this problem. Doesn't matter whether the doctor said that or not, right?
Yeah.
It's that because obesity intersects with so many other conditions, asthma, breast cancer, cardiovascular disease, all these other things that people often end up in their own heads or out loud from their physician or nurse or whomever, taking away, well, my weight is at the root of this other problem.
Right. Which I think is such an important message for any of the clinicians out there listening, to remind us that when someone comes in with a condition, any condition, whether it's completely unrelated, is to say, you did not bring this condition on. You know, you did not make this happen. And I think that's an important message, quite frankly, even obesity aside, you know, that so often people start thinking that, you know, I won't even get started with what's going on politically, but the idea that a woman takes a Tylenol, that this is going to impact the health of her unborn child. And the, you know, the guilt that suddenly is women are feeling about this. So, but it's the same kind of thing. You know, you don't make people feel guilty for stuff that happens.
So let's actually take that example just one step further, because I want to tell this t-shirt image and I'm going to share it with that example. Okay. So a woman who has a child with autism today probably feels a lot of shame if she has a chronic health condition and needed to take acetaminophen during her pregnancy. Whether or not that is true is beside the point. There's a lot of shame about that. And it is very possible to use that example, because the example that I gave in the Atlantic Festival is from one of my very smart patients. She said, I wish that people had to wear t-shirts that advertised what they feel shame about on their fronts. And they had to wear them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So they had to go into their job interview wearing it. They had to go into their high school class reunion wearing it. They had to walk down the aisle of their wedding wearing it. Right. And in this case, it could be, I took Tylenol during my pregnancy and my child has autism, right? Or whatever it is, something, it's not true.
The example you gave is I cheated on my taxes. And
I did. I said, I cheat on my taxes, or I cheat on my partner, or I have genital herpes is one that a lot of people have shame about, right? Not something that they did wrong, but something they have to manage. And yet they feel a lot of shame. I have chronic depression is something that in my practice, a lot of people feel really ashamed about. But imagine if you had to walk around every day wearing that. And the reason I use that as an example is because if you sit for just a second and imagine what it would be like to go to a job interview wearing a shirt that said, I'm unfaithful on my taxes or to my partner or something. How much judgment would be cast by the other person sitting across the desk from you before you have opened your mouth? That's what it's like to walk into a room living in a larger body in our world. The judgments that are cast that you are weak-willed, low in self-control, lacking willpower, lazy, less intelligent. These are all data-driven adjectives that we know are associated with people living with obesity.
Which, and I have to imagine that there's a very high correlation between being socially isolated and having obesity, because it's easier to just stay home than have to go out and brave the world, right?
Absolutely. Which then, of course, reinforces, you know, a smaller world doesn't help anyone's mental health. It also doesn't help anyone's health in general. We know this, right? Loneliness is a terrible thing for our cardiovascular health and all sorts of other outcomes.
Absolutely. But also, you know, big picture, and I know that you've spoken about this quite a bit, is how having obesity is actually in and of itself a barrier to getting appropriate treatment because of the shame. So talk about that a little bit, because I think where it comes into play is navigating the medical systems. I mean, it's one thing to go to your doctor and find out that you have, you know, you go in with a hangnail and they say, let's talk about your being overweight. But when you go to a doctor specifically because you do want to see what your options are to manage your obesity, what happens?
I will say, I'm going to give some credit to the medical community, because the last 5 years, there has been a significant increase in the number of people getting board certification in obesity medicine. And that is not a guarantee that there's not bias and stigma, but it is certainly a step in the right direction. Yeah. So there are definitely more and more medical providers that understand obesity as a chronic disease and are willing to talk about it that way. Medical professionals of all kinds. That's really important. That said, it's really challenging, I think, under the pressures of what a normal sort of everyday medical appointment looks like, where you have very short amount of time, lots of patients waiting, to give appropriate time for this complex conversation. And I think in general, it ends up being, okay, well, like, let's just try to get you to eat less and move more first. And then we'll go on to the next appointment where we talk about other things. And so it's a very disheartening experience if there is not a single person that has walked into my office and many of my friends' offices that has not tried every single version of every single diet plan on the market, right? Has every book, has every podcast, has every app, knows the calories involved in every food, the fat grams, the carbohydrates. I mean, right, really, really knowledgeable and has tried everything.
Another direct quote from you is, dieting is not obesity treatment. So yes. Explain why this diet culture is just so dangerous.
It is insidious, isn't it? It's again, going back to focusing on the wrong thing. Diet culture focuses on thinness. If we get right to the bottom line, obesity treatment focuses on health. And those two are so different. Now, I will say that there is a marketing is savvy, and there's a savvy push to market diets today as focusing on one's health, right? Typecasting your diet based on your genetics and all of these things. And really what I think if you dig under the surface just a little bit, the before and after pictures are about thinness. Yeah. They're about shape and size. They are not about A1C, blood pressure, cholesterol, right? You know, inflammatory.
Putting up their lab results in their before and after.
Exactly. Imagine if they did, right? That's what obesity treatment looks like. Yeah. We actually do compare. What is your A1C before and during treatment? What are your inflammatory markers before and after treatment?
Right. What is the goal? What is the goal of however it is that you choose to get to that goal? But let's be honest, there's a lot of money to be made in dieting and obesity. And, you know, this is kind of the same theme I have when, why is menopause suddenly so popular? It's not because anyone cares about women. It's because there's a lot of money to be made in the menopause space. And that has always, always been the case for dieting. And in fact, one of the things that I talked about, I have another book that I'm working on now coming out in a little bit. And I was talking to the publisher about, do we really need another menopause book? Don't we have enough? And they said, that's like saying we have enough books on diets. There's more books published in the dieting space than any other topic. Any other topic. And that's because there's a lot of money to be made. And as you said, and people are just, you know, desperately trying, well, this is going to be the one that's going to work.
Shame drives desperation.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, people who feel so much shame are desperate to get out from underneath the weight of it.
Yeah.
I am when I feel shame about something, whatever it is, right? We all are. That's a natural human instinct. Shame is intolerable when we carry it like that.
No, it's absolutely true. You know, you also talk about, we talk a lot about some of the challenges of being obese, of having obesity. And you talk about food noise versus shame noise while we're on this theme of shame. But could you talk about that? Because I think what you really are getting to, and this is what I want you to talk about, is getting rid of the food noise versus getting rid of the shame noise. So
yes. So this is is the best way I can articulate it. And it came out of work with one of my clients who, after some time, we kept talking about food noise. And it dawned on me that we were talking about different things because this person came in saying, I really need to get rid of my food noise. I really need to get rid of my food noise. But if we kept digging, what I learned is that the food noise was actually more about how embarrassing it was to have a stomach that looked this way or to have arms that didn't fit in this shirt, or to not fit in the plane seat for this upcoming trip and having to ask for the seatbelt extender. And I realized like that's not food noise, but it gets misconstrued because it's all about, you know, it gets triggered a lot in eating circumstances. So it can really easily be mistaken for food noise. So food noise is really about what is there to eat. Is there that leftover food in the fridge? Is the ice cream still in the fridge? Should I eat it? How much should I eat of it? you know, when will I eat again? When is the last time I ate? Am I hungry right now? Or is that just being triggered by the, you know, the smell of that restaurant that I just passed? That's what food noise sounds like. But you can understand how slippery that is into, didn't I just eat? What's wrong with me? Why am I thinking about food again? If I weren't, you know, struggling with my weight, or that's not how people talk to themselves, if I'm honest, right? If I weren't fat and lazy, which is what people say to themselves, if I weren't fat and lazy, I wouldn't be thinking about getting that pizza because I just walked by that pizza shop. Normal people don't think like that, but I'm the one that thinks like that because there's something wrong with me. And this is why I don't fit in my pants. And this is why I'm not going to get that promotion. And like, you can see how slippery that food noise is into the shame noise.
Okay. So as a clinical psychologist, how do you change that internal narrative? That's got to be difficult, right?
It is not easy. And the image I give to my patients is, think of it like this. We have a puzzle and we are dumping the puzzle pieces out on the table. And as much as you and I are educated and powerful and fast thinkers, right? You and I can dump the puzzle pieces out, and we still have to take the time to turn over every darn piece one by one before we can put them together. That's how this works in psychology. We don't just tell someone, oh, you have internalized weight bias. You have a shame cycle. Here's what it sounds like. Make it go away. That's like looking at the puzzle and saying, I see all the pieces, put it together.
Right.
It doesn't just happen overnight. You got to do it piece by piece. And sometimes that's like dismantling moments. So it might mean working with someone to have hard conversations with a spouse or a sister or a mom or, you know, someone who is really not understanding of their journey and makes comments and shames them. So maybe we do just one conversation. That's one puzzle piece. Maybe we talk about re-engaging in self-care in ways that people who feel ashamed tend to let go. So maybe they don't, honestly, you'll appreciate this one. I talk to almost every one of my clients about upgrading their underwear and bras. Why? Because if you feel ashamed of your body, you don't care if your underwear are holy and stretched out and old.
Right.
Right? That, to me, I will say, look in your underwear drawer. Do you have anything in there that is decent? And if the answer is no, there's shame to be found.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and one of the things actually we didn't talk about, and I haven't seen you talk about in any of the videos I looked at, is the sexual issues. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, part of being sexual, you know, having sex generally involves taking one's clothes off. And that can be really daunting for someone who feels shame about their body. And certainly one of the things I've talked about with women and with patients who talk about shame of their body, no matter what it is, whether it's that they have a big belly or they're wrinkled or they have scars or they have had a mastectomy or whatever. And I've always said, it's really important to have beautiful, beautiful lingerie that makes you feel sexy and wonderful, and maybe camouflage is the part that you're not feeling so good about. So, mm-hmm. You know, and remember, his eyesight isn't that great anyway, so don't get, you know, the lights all about. But the point is that everyone has something beautiful about their bodies, and it's a matter of what can I do to make, you know, that part of me shine and feel good.
Yes.
And I think that really is part of the discussion that needs to be had with people who it's nothing more than, you know, a big belly that is keeping them from being sexual.
Right. And I think so, to me, going out and purchasing, although, you know, these days we probably have to order it online, right? But like going out and finding better looking underwear and bras makes a person feel better about themselves. And that is that's another puzzle piece that we've put back in the puzzle.
It's true of any weight. I'm just throwing that out there.
Every weight, yes.
For everybody. Everybody. Yes.
At every weight. But so when, as a clinical health psychologist, I'm thinking about how do I help this person turn over their puzzle pieces? They have to have patience because it takes a long time. A lot of times these beliefs and ways of seeing themselves in the world has been not only internalized, but been reinforced by society for decades, generations often.
Yeah.
So it doesn't happen overnight, but it does.
Right. And the other thing that, and we're going to talk a bit more about this, about how do people get the kind of support that you give, but But one of the things which is becoming, I think, a real issue is when you look at the GLP-1 drugs, which we don't want to get into a whole discussion about that. We've certainly talked about that a lot before. But from your point of view as a clinical psychologist, a lot of people are getting these drugs online through telehealth. And you find that to be problematic, correct?
I'd find it problematic when they don't have adequate care associated with the prescription.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Right. There are... The drug alone is not treatment. Right. Can you imagine ordering your chemotherapy online?
Yeah.
No, right. That's absurd to imagine someone saying, okay, you have, you know, stage 2 ovarian cancer. You're going to need this drug. Go ahead and order it online. Follow up with me in a year. That is absurd. No one would ever think that is comprehensive quality care.
Right. Right.
That's what we do in obesity medicine for many people. Now, there's lots of reasons for that. And telehealth by itself ordering isn't necessarily the problem. It's the lack of wraparound care that's the problem. So in my mind, what I would hope for is that if people are going to use online sources, A, they use reputable sources, because much of the stuff getting pushed, you know, in advertisements to us, patches and rubs and creams and all of this is all nonsense. So I would hope that they would use reputable sources, but then that they would also be talking actively with a therapist or a nutritionist or a dietitian or a medical provider, a medical professional of any type to treat their condition in the most effective way, which we know is comprehensive care.
Yeah. In a perfect world, right?
In a perfect world. Yeah.
So I want to circle to something else, because in one of your very viral videos called What We Carry, you use this brilliant device of walking on stage wearing this enormous backpack filled with, you know, things that represented the baggage that people with obesity live with, and which ultimately impacts their mental health, or is, you know, let's just get a little bit of an insight into their mental health. And I'm going to put that link in the show note, because everyone has to watch this video. It is so great. But I do want to talk about a couple of things that you pulled out of your backpack.
Yes.
And the first thing that you pulled out, it was a big backpack, I'm just going to say. The first thing you pulled out was a scale. And you put that scale on the stage and you stepped on it.
Oh, when I hear you say that, I still get goosebumps. Seriously. I can't believe I weighed myself. I can't believe I did it. I really debated when I was writing this talk, should I wait till the end and do it, or should I start with that? And I thought, you know what? The truth is, for most of us, it always has felt like it, meaning our journey with weight starts and ends with the stupid scale. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to just start out of the gate with it, because it is so relatable. It is the thing that people fear when they feel out of control of their weight, and the thing that people run to when they are feeling in control of their weight. So oftentimes it's people avoid the scale altogether when they feel like their weight is up above where it quote unquote should be. And then other times when they're losing weight, they may get on the scale 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day, because they want to see the reinforcement, right? Either way, the scale has its claws in anyone who has struggled with weight over time.
But I think it goes beyond that even. I mean, you talked about that the scale is a measurement of your self-worth, you know?
Absolutely.
And that somehow there's this self-loathing if the number is not what it's supposed to be. And I mean, that's kind of translate to a lot more in someone's life than just their struggle with having obesity.
Yes. I mean, think about it. Imagine if you weighed yourself most mornings and you spent the moments before you weighed yourself gripped with anxiety because the scale was going to tell you your destiny. Basically, that's what it feels like. It's like the jury coming back, right? Are you a felon or not? Yes or no? Because people who are living with chronic weight concerns, when they step on that scale, the number doesn't just represent the force of gravity pulling on their bodies, which is what it actually represents. The number on the scale to them, to me over time, represents, are you good or bad? Are you worthy or not? And it is that people carry with them throughout the day and throughout their lifetime often.
So with when you're working with someone who is in this journey, if you will, do you tell them not to weigh themselves? What do you advise?
So if we look at the literature on behavioral weight management, we know that weighing regularly is actually a very effective tool to help people manage their weight over time. That said, it is an individualized case-by-case basis, depending on whether or not someone has a history of disordered eating, whether or not someone has a history of body dysmorphia type things, very, severe body image concerns. Also, if someone has sort of obsessive ruminative thoughts, depending on how intense that internalized weight bias is for that person. So I don't have a quick answer because it really depends on the person sitting in front of me.
Yeah.
Some people need to weigh every day and do so very effectively and healthy and in a very healthy way. Other people have to have I have some clients that own scales in kilograms rather than pounds because they don't have the same sting from that third or fifth grade experience seeing the number when it's in a different metric system, basically. I have some clients that have numberless scales because they want the metrics to be sent to their healthcare provider because what they care about in the big picture is their health, but they know themselves well enough to know that the anxiety is too much.
Well, and that's like in the doctor's office, if a woman doesn't want to be weighed, and I would always give that option, but I would also give her the option of getting on the scale backwards, and I'm not going to tell you the weight.
Right.
And the only time I would insist on it is if someone was having surgery and you need to know the weight for anesthesia, and you do want to get the right amount of anesthesia, or if someone's pregnant. But I do think it is important to not force someone to get weighed unless there's a true medical reason why that weight would be useful, and then give the option of saying, you don't need to know, but I need to know.
Right. That's one of those strange things, though, that because I think generations of people were brought up to believe that the healthcare professional is an authority figure. And so when they say, do this, we are to do that. Right. And I think we fall into that way of thinking, that ethos, that sort of mental ethos very quickly.
Right.
And so,
well, in fact, I'm writing an article right now for my Substack about how to make a visit to the gynecologist not quite so awful. And when I talk about the getting weighed thing, the phrase that I use is, this isn't the army. You know, when you are told get on the scale, you don't have to say, yes, sir, and jump on there. You can say, I'm wondering if this is medically necessary, or, can I just pass on this or whatever. But I mean, exactly to your point, that people have this idea that this is a command as opposed to, this is information that we think would be useful, in which case, as a patient, you have the right to say, okay, I'm just wondering why this is information that you would like to have.
Right.
Why do you need it? Because there is a really good reason for it.
Yes.
And,
Or like, I understand that you might need this information, but it's not helpful in my process. And so I just choose to turn away.
Yeah.
Right. It's so empowering for people when they learn they can do that. And I'm just surprised at how unbelievably educated professional people, I have to remind them of that, because again, we just sort of put on the gown and slip into a different role, mentally.
Well, the other problem, quite frankly, is it's not generally the doctor that's doing the weighing.
Right.
It's usually a medical assistant and someone who maybe hasn't been coached in how to frame this. And she's just got to check off the boxes. She's just filling out the chart. So, just like she takes your blood pressure and your pulse and your temperature and says, and now it's time to get on the scale. And if someone were to say to her why, she might look at that person blankly and truly not know, because it's just on her to-do list. So there's that also, which makes it a little bit more complicated.
Yes.
All right, back to your backpack.
Yes.
You then pull out some handcuffs at one point.
Yes.
Talk about why handcuffs made it into your backpack.
So many things made it in there, but I like to talk about the handcuffs because it's a little out there, right? But handcuffs to me represent the shackles that we feel when it feels like the world tells us there, when you live with obesity, that there is one right way that you should be eating and moving and sleeping and managing your stress, right? Because we're now we're now beyond eat less, move more, but we're now at eat less, move more, sleep more, stress less. Those are the four tenets. And they're not bad tenets, but they're not the whole picture. But it always feels like we're not doing the right thing. So we're sort of handcuffed into there's a right way to do it. And people end up, not surprisingly, often not being able to follow that exact program perfectly and therefore end up feeling like criminals. Like, if this is what it takes to be a worthy human being and I am consistently breaking the rules, right, then I'm basically a criminal. I'm doing everything wrong. I'm going against the grain. And so I used the handcuffs to symbolize just how badly we feel about ourselves when we can't live up to whatever diet expectation has been set for us, whether that's a book we read, an app we heard, a doctor told us this is what worked for her or him, right? And that therefore we should do that. And it's just like, we just feel like criminals over and over and over again. If we were just better people, we could do it.
And failures. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, is that pressure for perfection and feeling like a failure because you somehow did not meet the expectations that you were supposed to.
All the time. Right.
Yeah. You know, so I asked you this question in Sardinia, and I really liked your answer. So I'm going to ask it again, because this has happened to me a number of times. You know, I run into a friend that I haven't seen for a long time, and she's clearly lost an enormous amount of weight. And I think we all could use a little help with, what do you say? On one hand, you want to acknowledge the fact that she's, you know, had this change, this transformation, but is it appropriate to say, you know, like, oh my God, you look amazing, you've lost a ton of weight, or, you know, what can you give us a script? What should you say to someone who has clearly lost a lot of weight?
This is applicable both in social settings, family settings, but also in medical settings, okay? Because I can't tell you the number of times doctors inadvertently do that as well. Right? A patient you haven't seen in 6 months or a year walks into your office down 50 pounds, 80 pounds. It's like gut instinct to say, oh my gosh, you look great. You look amazing. Let me encourage every single person listening to please say, it is so good to see you. How are you feeling? Instead, start there. Here's why. Number one, you acknowledge that it is good to see the person, not the person's body. Number two, you then have given that person autonomy in whether or not to say, I've lost a lot of weight. Some people want you to acknowledge their weight. And if they want you to acknowledge it, they will say, I'm feeling so great. I've lost 50 pounds. I started a med, or I had surgery, or I've been doing X, Y, and Z. They want to talk about it. And if they want to talk about it, then talk about it with them, right? Some people hear you look amazing as the heads on the coin, and the tail is the subtext of before you looked terrible when you had that extra 50 pounds on. And what the person immediately is likely to think is, what happens if my weight goes back up? What happens if I regain? Will that doctor or that friend think, oh, wow, you know, or will they be silent next time I see them if I've regained some weight, and how will that make me feel? And also don't forget that there's lots of reasons people lose weight beyond self-control and willpower and meds. Some people have illnesses. Some people have eating disorders. Some people have grief and loss that they are coping with. There's so many reasons that people lose weight beyond trying.
That are not success stories. That are
right. They're not all success stories, right? And I just think it's such a short-sighted way of trying to engage with that person in a meaningful way. And so let's get to the person, not the weight.
Okay, so let's flip this, because most people don't have this script. So if you are someone who has just lost a lot of weight, however you did it, it doesn't matter, but you've lost a lot of weight, and this well-meaning person comes up to you and says, oh my God, you look amazing. Did you start a GLP-1? How do you tell your clients to respond to that?
Yeah. Oh, that happens.
A lot.
So there's a couple ways to do that. Number one is if you feel, depending on sort of how confident you feel in that dynamic and in that relationship, you can say, I actually don't like to talk much about my weight, but I can tell you that I'm feeling really well and healthy, right? You can sort of divert it and just outright say that. You can also say, thanks for noticing. I'd rather talk about it, you know, how good I feel or the trip that I just went on. You can sort of divert it that way. Or if honestly, if depending on the type of relationship again, you can say, that's actually really personal information.
Yeah.
You can see that.
So it's kind of like when I was doing obstetrics and women would have, you know, carrying twins, and someone would come up to them and say, did you take fertility drugs? Which is basically the same inappropriate question. And I would always tell my patients, they say, what do I say when someone asks? And I would say the way that you answer that is, why do you ask?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because I want to know. Why do you want to know? Because I'm curious. Why are you so curious? You know, and you just keep turning it back to them, which, yes, you know, is not always easy to do. But I mean, the point is people are going to say inappropriate things. And I think it is important that people have a tool to know how to respond to that.
Yes. And you could absolutely use that. I love that. You could use that absolutely with the GLPs, right? Like, oh, why do you want to know?
Quite frankly.
Yes, you know, it does. You know, because and
dye your hair. Why do you ask? You
know? Right. And this is one of those things where, again, the roles matter so much, because I think we sort of feel like if we get asked a question or told something that we have to respond.
Right.
And we don't.
No, people ask all kinds of things that are truly none of their business. And we can always say that's none of your goddamn business. But most of us, for a variety of reasons, would rather not do that. So you just say really sweetly with a smile, why do you ask?
Yes.
No matter what inappropriate question is. All right. So, okay, look, in a perfect world, every single person with obesity would get to see you in addition to their medical care.
Yeah.
But you've already pointed out, and we know that clinical psychologists who really understand having obesity are basically non-existent, and most people are not going to have access short of cloning you into like 1,000,000,000 yous. So how do women get the emotional support that they need as they are, even if they are getting appropriate medical care, if they're taking a drug or whatever they're doing? What do you tell women when you're talking to big groups of women and you know that access is a problem? How do they get this emotional support?
Yeah. So there's, I'll put a plug in for a couple of the communities that I'm very actively involved in. So one is the Obesity Action Coalition. I'm on the board of directors for that organization. It's a patient-facing organization, nonprofit, and their whole goal is to educate and bring awareness about the disease of obesity. And there are education sessions, there's live in-person conferences, which is actually where I gave that talk, my viral talk that was filmed at one of their annual conventions. So there are communities.
Who was in that audience? Was that healthcare clinicians or was that just non-healthcare clinicians or was it a combination?
Combination.
Who was in the audience? Yeah.
Yes. It was a combination of patients living with obesity, care providers, and healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So there's that organization and others similar out there that are really powerful places where people can find mutual connection and support. A lot of it is virtual too. So it opens up access, and a lot of it is free or very, very, very low cost. Again, opening up access.
And I will put those links in the program notes so
yes.
people can find them.
Yes. The other thing is there are a number of therapists who do understand shame. And so I think a person living with obesity who is aware that they have internalized this bias and are living with intense shame about it, if they can find a therapist who may be able to talk to them about managing shame, that is a bit of a backdoor approach to figuring out how to navigate this world of living with obesity. And depending on the clinician, I mean, I know a lot of amazing psychologists and therapists and counselors who want to know more and are willing to do the work if they have a, you know, sort of a relationship with a patient that will bring them along that journey. So not that I hate to say like it's the patient's job to educate the therapist, but I think in some cases, if we know that this is important to us and we find a safe relationship, don't be afraid to talk about it with the with the person that you trust and say, like, hey, let's figure this out together. Because the elements of dealing with shame, as you and I talked about, right? It can be with a gynecological issue. It can be with obesity. It can be with, depression or anxiety, all these different places. It's an overlapping issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And in my world, where we see this most often is women who have chronic pelvic pain or sexual pain.
Yes.
And particularly if they are looking at being in a new relationship or having problems with an ongoing relationship, it's my fault. I'm ashamed. Yes. I am not able to have, mind-blowing, amazing sex like their perception that every other woman on earth is having, which they certainly are not.
Right. So,
okay, you didn't talk about your book. What about your book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So there's that. So I'm co-author with several of my my grad school mentor and some colleagues on a book called The New Food Fight. And in it, what we do is we basically break down and dispel what we call sticking points, but really going through that why in the world of obesity treatment and eating disorders, the two have remained almost entirely separate entities. So in research funding, in scientific conferences, in writing academic papers, and in practices, like clinical practices, you have eating disorder practices and you have weight-focused or obesity-focused practices. You just don't really see the intersection. I happen to have one of the practices that does both of those because I understand the intersection of these two issues. So the book is talking about what happened. Why is this the case? Why and what is it doing to average consumers, patients out there who may have disordered eating and live with obesity or are on a weight journey and struggle with disordered eating? And how does that impact their care? And then what do we do about it as a field moving forward? So we put forth some recommendations and of course, it won't surprise you to know that the common ground across both of these fields is to reduce stigma related to a person's body shape and size.
And this sounds like a book that would be appropriate for both clinicians and non-clinicians, correct?
Yes, it drove our editors and marketing teams crazy that we wouldn't say it's for one or either one of those groups. We just kept saying it has to be for both, right?
Correct.
Just that patient, the talk audience that I gave, it's a mix because the truth is, there are many, many healthcare professionals out there that struggle with weight and disordered eating also.
Right.
It just because you're a doctor doesn't mean you haven't ever struggled with any of this stuff. So
one more time, what's the name of that book?
It's called The New Food Fight.
The New Food Fight. When did it come out? Is it new or has it been out?
It came out in July. So it's new.
So is it?
Newbie.
It's brand new.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I have to get a copy. I'm excited to read that. That sounds like something that every human being should read, quite frankly.
I think so, yes.
I think so.
And then they should leave an amazing review on Amazon or on Barnes & Noble, please.
I will be sure and do that. Now, listen, as an author, those reviews mean a lot.
You really
and
do.
When you get a bad review, it just is like a stab. It shouldn't bother you. I should have thicker skin. I had one woman that with one of my like two or three books ago that left me one star because she said the font, the print was too small. And I'm thinking, well, that's not my fault. That was the publisher. And it brought down my star rating. And, and I just had someone leave me a one star review on my podcast because they said I was too political because I was talking about the FDA panel and why I didn't go because it was really political circus, not, medical, when politics is medicine right now. But still, I mean, my point is those reviews matter. So please, good reviews make my day, especially when someone writes something nice. I do read them. It matters. And bad reviews do make me feel bad. What can I say?
Yes.
All right. God, this has been so good. I could keep talking to you, but we can't. We both have other things we need to get to. There was the last word, when you were doing the Atlantic thing and they did the usual, okay, what's your last word? And I loved what you ended with. Do you remember that? Can you
say it for me and then I'll tell you why I said it.
The psychological aspects of having obesity are rarely recognized. The psychological burden that people carry outweighs the adipose tissue.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it should be a Whitman sampler, you know?
Oh my gosh. Yes. It takes my breath away to think about how important it is for every single person living with obesity to hear that. Because, we joke that there's not very many psychologists that specialize in obesity, But there's a reason for that. It's because the psychology of obesity is so misunderstood and so poorly recognized because people, again, think it's all about willpower. And instead, psychology in weight management has been behavior change, motivation, right? Let's get this person motivated to lose the weight. And that is just such a disservice to patients living with chronic disease. And so I have just been witness to the burdens that people carry, the shame, the guilt, the perfectionism, the feeling of failure, the feeling of lack of worthiness, the unlovability that exists alongside living with obesity in a culture that does not value that. And I'll tell you what, that weighs way more than 50 pounds of adipose tissue.
And I'm going to end with that because I think that there's nothing left to say. Thank you. Thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you.